So, deconstructing the taxonomy of modern Hinduism. So as you can probably guess, you already know from a minute ago, my area of interest is specifically looking at the colonial period and the interaction between European missionaries, scholars, and institutions with indigenous actors, and how that led to the formalization of what we know of as modern Hinduism. So just by focusing on specifically modern Hinduism and how it was categorized into kind of broadly reformist and traditionalist areas, how that kind of has affected our current understanding of Hinduism. That was what I became mainly interested in. And so today, what I'm hopefully going to try and focus on is the ways in which we can delve into these dominant understandings and open them up and kind of uncover the different voices that were perhaps silenced during the kind of colonial orientalist operations that were going on during this time, and to kind of hopefully create a more kind of informed understanding of the different traditions and the nature of modern Hinduism in both the kind of scholarly and the public arena. So, go first slide, please. So, you know, trying to make it relevant, don't have to justify it in this scenario. I'm sure everyone knows how relevant and amazing this kind of title is. But for other people, you know, this kind of the questions raised in this do actually have kind of direct relevance for kind of pre-colonial traditions or Indic traditions study in general. Because, you know, kind of the legitimacy is always questioned if we kind of project anachronistically back onto pre-colonial traditions these understandings that we have. And also, as we know, the election going on right now, the influence of this kind of process, thank you very much, on the kind of Hindu politics is quite pertinent. You can see the lineage, intellectual lineage for most political parties stretches back to this period of colonial contact. So, you know, and politicians, as it were, kind of seems to have the kind of the authority to define the nature of Hinduism. And from my limited understanding of kind of Indian institutions and universities, there's not so much discussion about the nature of Hinduism in this regard. So, you know, it could have some quite contemporary significance, this kind of study. So we could just have the next slide, please. So just an overview of what my actual talk's going to be like, the structure today. So I'm just going to start off with an overview of the grand narrative, the kind of the scholarly grand narrative to which this research fits and the idea of the construction of Hinduism. And then I was just going to delve into the main methodological and theoretical critiques of the kind of current taxonomy of modern Hinduism that we have and that we work with predominantly in the Western Academy. And then I'm going to test the validity of this taxonomy through looking at the case study of a specific Bengali Vaishnav, a theologian of the late 19th, early 20th century. Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati is his name. And then at the end, my most controversial aspect and the least developed, which I'm kind of hoping to flesh out today and get some feedback on, is just the proposition of a new approach to kind of studying modern Hinduism in light of kind of inadequacy to cover this specific case study. Next slide, please. So, I'll just briefly go over the kind of the construction of Hinduism debate, which I'm sure you're all quite well aware of. It kind of, you know, begun in one sense with Edward Said's Orientalism in 1978. And since then, the kind of post-colonial scholars have kind of emerged and kind of developed Said's work. And in the 80s and 90s, it kind of peaked, specifically with Richard King's Orientalism, Post-Colonial Theory in the Mystic East, also Indians Imagining Hinduism. But the focus of these two scholars was on the kind of the British colonial authorities and the scholars often being one and the same, and the way in which they kind of defined Indian communities from the late 18th century onwards, and how, with the kind of result of improved bureaucratic means of rule. And these observations have become, you know, the veracity of these have become more obvious over later years as the study is developed. But the explicit focus of these two on the kind of the Orientalist operations that were occurring during this period has led some to kind of go a bit fanatical, as it were, and to kind of take an ahistorical view of this period and claim that Hinduism, you know, did not exist before, you know, the introduction and the interaction with European scholars. I'm thinking of Fitzgerald and Fritz Stahl, people like this. And so this has led to the kind of, as I call them, the kind of the defender notion by people such as Brian Pennington. So can we put the next slide, please? Who's kind of tried to counter this radical interpretation and kind of builds an argument which kind of attempts to challenge what he sees as this increasingly popular perception of Hinduism as being a Western construct just imposed on a passive Indian population. And so he kind of, well, from my view, I think Pennington kind of misunderstands the position of the constructionists, such as King and Indon, who they were merely focusing on the Orientalist kind of role in the construction of Hinduism during that period, and that was a focus, but that doesn't mean that they kind of denied any agency during this process, or the process, or the presence of any other factors. And in fact, the kind of King himself claims that this notion of agency is actually a key component of a post-Saidian analysis. But Pennington kind of expresses concern that the theories were kind of arguing that religion is a meaningless construct and that Hinduism is a bungled Western construct, and that he was worried, quote, that the claim that these should be abandoned, that effectively undercuts the geopolitical claims of some Hindus to be taken seriously after centuries of stereotyping, misrepresentation and demonising by the Christian West, end quote. So basically he argues that scholars of South Asia, such as most of us here, I guess, the kind of need to remain sensitive to the views of Hindus themselves, and to be understood on their own terms according to their own categories. But interestingly, this is exactly the same criticism that the constructionists, such as King, kind of level as well. They're saying, you know, when they're talking about the usefulness of applying terms such as Hinduism to pre-colonial traditions, is that being understood on their own terms? And then another just important voice I'll just throw in here now just is Nicholson's insights. He demonstrates that the limitations of the two extreme views on the idea of Hinduism, the first one being the construction of Hinduism, the Western construction of Hinduism, but also the other end of the spectrum, the idea that the Hinduism was an eternal monolithic reality, you know, that's kind of been unchanged for thousands of years. The understanding of Hinduism that underlies the ideology of most kind of Hindu nationalists. But he attempts to show that how what we label as Hindu now, the systems of thought we think of as Hindu, were actually engaged in kind of a sharp polemic division between heterodox and orthodox philosophical schools way before the colonial period. And they're along similar lines, although not identical, to what we actually consider to be the Hindu identity today. So he argues that the development of Hinduism as a unified religion can be traced back to this period, not just the Western construction and the Western colonial interaction. So if we look at these two together, you know, if we combine the two, if we accept Nicholson's claim as to the pre-colonial roots of Hindu identity, and also Pennington's claim that to understand Hindus on their own terms according to their own categories is paramount, with King and Indon's observations as to the colonial Orientalist role in solidifying some of these processes, and together it raises a lot of interesting kind of theoretical and ethical questions. And how do we actually access these traditions then that went through this process, and how do we actually understand and treat the various manifestations of Hinduism that we encounter? So that's what I'm going to move on to now, looking at briefly outlining the kind of the presuppositions that underlie the dominant taxonomies of modern Hinduism that we have. So if you can have the next slide, please. So this here, this handy little diagram, is a kind of the most up-to-date one that I've managed to find of the taxonomical schema of modern Hinduism. And this is the one specifically from Elizabeth de Michelis's History of Modern Yoga. And she works off of the work of John Farquhar and David Kopf, but most notably Paul Hacker and Wilhelm Halbwass. And so you can see just on the side, you know, it creates a distinction between classical Hinduism and modern Hinduism. And this term classical Hinduism is kind of a bit kind of ambiguous, making it seem like it was a static entity back then, especially when we consider Nicholson's kind of insights that perhaps, you know, that there was a lot more going on during that period. They're complicated, but I won't get into that now. As I say, you know, that's an interesting area of research that we should look into more. But I'm looking at the modern Hinduism down here. So she kind of follows, you know, Kopf and Halbwass and other people, and dividing it into kind of modern Hindu traditionalism and neo-Hinduism, as it were. And this kind of reflects Halbwass's conclusions that neo-Hinduism and traditionalism they're the two main trends of modern, and the way that the Hinduism interacted with the West. And she adds herself to this category, the two different orientations of Hindu traditionalism. And so the form of classical Hinduism that kind of apparently carried on as if untouched or not at all affected, And the second is this modern Hindu traditionalism, which she actually put in, and she characterises as having been affected by and kind of creatively interacting with the West. So one of the main problems that you see with this kind of taxonomy, that even though it's kind of seen as, you know, just a model in which it can be used to help, to be helpful, but it just does still dangerously essentialize, you know, just with terms such as modern and classical, and they have their own conceptual limitations, you know. Like when you study individuals, you know, they pass through many of these different categories throughout their whole life, so to allow for that as well would be, seems to be necessary. But on top of this, it kind of, you know, seems as a deeper problem, and the underlying kind of basis upon which this taxonomy is structured, and the kind of the presuppositions that are there when we actually investigate into the intellectual lineage of those that that created it. So, you know, namely, I'm thinking of the kind of the Protestant missionary mentality of people like John Farquhar, who's the like an early 20th century missionary scholar in India, and the Orientalist canon that kind of underlay the work of the German works of people like Hacker and Halfass, and that's what causes the major kind of methodological problems that we have here. So the traditional, you know, approach that was taken by these scholars and missionaries, you know, at best was the kind of the idea, the understanding of a kind of an imposition of a superior Western kind of conceptual and religious framework onto a weaker native mindset. Or there's also now the kind of the equally kind of simplistic notion of just a blending of kind of cultural world views. And neither of them really kind of provides that kind of conduit to examine where the indigenous agency and the kind of the true impact of that on this process. So this is a kind of a specific point where I kind of bring my theoretical and kind of methodological critique and my kind of alternative to bear by kind of looking at the specific case study of one Bengali religious personality, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati. So can we just have the next slide, please? So just a brief bio on him, because you probably haven't heard of him. He seems seemingly obscure due to this taxonomy, I guess. So as you see, he was born in late 19th century and passed away just before Second World War, and he established of 64 religious centres all around India, which and his institution was known as the Gaudiya Math. And in India, he initiated over 60,000 disciples, but he also sent some of his disciples as missionaries to England, Germany, and also Burma. And the next slide, actually, there's just, I found this quite interesting picture. So this is one of his, I think, yeah, Swami Bon, one of his missionaries that sent to London and Germany. And these two spectacle gentlemen are these German disciples, two of them, that came back to India. So I found that's quite an interesting picture, just to give you a sense of the outreach of the movement. So Bhaktisiddhanta as well was also, can we just go back a slide actually, sorry. He was also a kind of prolific author and writer. So I chose that picture. And, you know, he had daily, weekly and monthly periodicals. And so this is the main source that we have, so to kind of have an insight into his particular subjective understandings of his position within the dominant discourses and trends of the time. And so he was also known for his intense oratory and being called the Lion Guru, Acharya Kishari. So his writings and speeches, which were speeches were often transposed into his publications. That's where we can get a sense of Bhaktisiddhanta and the fact that he opposed the kind of the monistic interpretation of Hinduism at the time, or Advaita, that kind of emerged as the prevalent strand of Hindu thought in India at the time. And consequently, this became taken up by Western institutions as the core of Hinduism, and which is specifically represented in the kind of the Neo-Vedanta category of the Michelis in one of the Neo-Hinduism taxonomies. So consequently, by studying Bhaktisiddhanta, you can see that he kind of represents a different trajectory within modern Hinduism. So at first glance, he seems to kind of fall into the categorization of a traditionalist, because he focused quite specifically on reviving, you know, like a Brahminic, kind of Sanskritized Vaishnav lineage. And he often referred to kind of pre-modern Bhakti literature to identify his theological and philosophical core. And this is seen as like classic hallmark traditionalism, you know, collecting something pre-modern and reviving it. That's often seen as kind of traditionalist. But then there's also just aspects of his when you look at his lectures and his writing and his activities, he displayed many of the kind of reformist traits as well that would put him in the neo-Vedanta category with people such as Swami Vivekananda and Ramahan Roy. For example, he's often quite strongly targeted like the ritualistic casteism of the kind of the smarter brahmanas or the dominant religious class of the time, and also the kind of the centralized and eroticized practices of many other Gaudiya Vaishnav groups that he, you know, considered deviations from the kind of the original Gaudiya Vaishnav core. And his institutional and his organizational and his technological kind of approach, the setting up all these institutions and kind of mass publication through the printing press, that also just, you know, has the hallmarks of a kind of a reformist. So the interesting thing about his position within modern Hinduism is that, you know, he encompassed both these traditionalist and reformist aspects, and, you know, so he can't be easily categorized into either. So as Ferdinando Sardelli recently wrote a book on him, kind of said that, you know, he didn't try to adjust the core understanding of his tradition to suit the sensibilities of the time, as many considered the kind of the neo-Vedantins to do, but he tried to effect a change to the periphery, just its expression and its dress, as it were. So there's a number of studies kind of tend to categorize him either as a traditionalist or as a reformist. So Ferdinando Sardelli kind of brings them together into a compromise, and he adds to it another sub-branch of the taxonomy for Vedantic personalism to try and encompass his theological contribution. And it would be easy to just, you know, just go with that and stop there, but, you know, I've always wanted to be a little bit radical, so I'm not convinced by it completely. But, you know, so now is where I'm kind of not entirely convinced by the whole taxonomy and whether or not it's actually going to be resolve all of the problems that we've previously looked at in our underlying presuppositions, and is it really going to be helpful for our future study of Hinduism and understanding all the different aspects and the different kind of ways, the religious traditions of the time, if we kind of just add a small sub-branch to it. And so this is where I'm kind of inclined to develop a more dialogical approach that kind of takes inspiration from the modes of thought and the traditions themselves to represent a more accurate, if not still temporal, kind of understanding of Hinduism during the period. And so I propose this can be adopted specifically through a hermeneutical phenomenology, which I will just briefly explain, specifically as that develops a little bit by the good professor sitting just next door, Kevin Clark, as my supervisor of this project. Could I have the next slide, please? Oh, yeah, the next one. Do you figure in that? I don't think so. It would probably be aghast at what I'm doing as well. So, I'll just briefly explain it now, because I know I want to make time for Sachi. But so the method I'm proposing here to kind of create a new way to studying Hinduism that can kind of undercut all of these problems that we're looking at is a hermeneutical phenomenology. So ideally it will be phenomenological and allowing the structure of the traditions themselves to show themselves through the texts that we're studying. And hermeneutical, and by highlighting the meaning of tradition and the meaning of being itself for these practitioners such as Bhaktisiddhanta, who have stood and they continue to stand within the traditions that we're actually concerned with. So it's also hermeneutical in allowing to show that what shows itself not only shows itself through the signs, but then needs to be interpreted and represented by us. So the phenomenological approach to understanding the kind of the inner hermeneutics of Hinduism, then that's what's necessary for us to first understand the worldview of Hinduism. And if we combine that with the post-colonial critiques of people like King and Indon, and the understanding that the theoretical frameworks that we have and that have dominated our understanding of Hinduism have created this impasse and this Western bias that we just that kind of taints our view when we're studying modern Hindu traditions, then hopefully through this we can understand our biases and overcome them and come to a more profitable understanding and allow kind of indigenous conceptual frameworks to come through which that we can create a further study of Hinduism. So it will be hopefully dialogical and resist this totalization and this essentialization and the violence that it's caused, and kind of in time lead to the redundancy of the previous taxonomies that we looked at, which should continue to perpetuate through a conceptual framework that's been developed from within traditions. So that's essentially my dissertation proposal. So thank you very much.
So we open it up to questions now?
Yeah, any feedback? we highly
this is a critique. This is
yeah, no, any critiques also welcome. So
I like your approach.
Yeah, thank
and
you.
I agree with it. The only issue that I have is the text bit.
Mm.
If you're only focusing on allowing traditions to express themselves through text, what about traditions who don't have text, who focus on ritual, who might not even be literate, might surely be ignoring the section of society?
Yeah, that's true. I shouldn't have cut out this last paragraph I had that covered that the same here. Because I was just looking at the time and thought, I'll skip past this.
Okay,
I don't go up and ask advice. But yeah, so saying that the kind of all of the material aspects of the traditions themselves, material in the way that they can be interpreted and kind of studied, so that does encompass as well. I was meaning to say texts and also traditions, you know, rituals as it were. So we can stand outside of the texts and practices and kind of look in. And so that's the way we can understand these kind of the subjectivity that they point to within there. So yeah, but thanks for that. I need to make sure I do include that, cause not just texts.
How does this phenomenological approach sort of differ from like traditional phenomenology of religion, which people like McCutcheon etc. have criticised over the years? I don't mean to be throwing
that's good.
Hermeneutical always seems a bit vague when people. I mean, when I use it, I don't really know what I'm.
Yeah.
So maybe I'm just imposing that on others.
Yeah, no.
But I mean, how is it different from phenomenology? What is phenomenology?
So I guess all I could answer here is from the perspective that I'm taking it from, as in how is it hermeneutical? And I guess, yeah, when you cloak it in quite complex language to say, you know, the nature of being in itself, what it means. When I went to Gavin and asked him what that actually means, you know, he was like, yeah, you just, you know, you read what they, you know, you just read it as it is, you know, and see what it says, you know.
Yeah.
So I guess I could have been a little bit clearer in that respect, but I can't. So I'll just take it from Gavin's words, you know. So yeah, I can't really give a greater in-depth insight into how it differs from normal phenomenology, but just kind of just trying to understand back to Siddhanta's perspective or whoever's perspective we're studying and how they view the different perspectives.
But I guess it is kind of a crucial question in the sense that, like, you're trying to distinguish what you're doing from, let's say, Ferdinando Sargella, you know, who recently did, you know, you went over that.
Yeah.
And he seems to have come up with something that would appear to be taking into consideration the way traditions themselves, you know, at least the modern Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition understands itself with this kind of category of Vedantic personalism.
Mm.
So what's going to differentiate what you're doing from? Because I think I even you know, I kind of remember him noting in a footnote. He said, "This is also this is a dialogical, hermeneutical, phenomenological approach." Quoting the Flood, 1999.
I should read the footnotes. Yeah. But I guess. I mean, I don't know if he's exactly looking to kind of make the other taxonomy redundant. But I guess I could take a lot from his approach and the way he's doing it. I'm not sure how it differentiates so much. I've probably got a lot more to learn from him, but I guess my idea is to kind of start from within the tradition to create an understanding and a taxonomy, as opposed to just adapting it into fit into the taxonomy that's already there. I guess so. I guess I'm trying to start from within the tradition as opposed to start from without.
So it's a theological enterprise in a sense.
I guess in Gavin's book he says that this approach is very similar to kind of a theological understanding, like an interpretation. It has many of the same hallmarks. So in that respect, methodologically, it would be
okay. Interesting.
Thanks.
I think the problematic that you laid out is very interesting in terms of the binary that you put between the traditionalist or revivalist, however or maybe even the reformist community come under it. And then you propose dialectical hermeneutics or hermeneutical phenomenology. And I think maybe what dialogical hermeneutics will help as well, and I'm wondering if you're interested in that, is problematize the very idea of that binary itself. Because when we are talking about revivalist and reformist, we have to understand that they are people who are sharing the same public space. So they are discoursing at the same time. So revivalists does not necessarily mean they are pre-modern, and they are also looking for ways to engage with how the world is changing. But engaging it through a different answers by going back to some of the classical literature. And so in that sense, my point is, they are still sharing the same public discourse where they are still, I mean, you can still categorize them as belonging to modern Hinduism and break that distinction. And I think at least my understanding of hermetical phenomenology will sort of inform that binary itself in terms of disrupting it.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Thanks, yeah.
Yeah, I guess it just shows how much, even though trying to deconstruct them, how much I do rely upon them to just explain it. So it's kind of that vicious circle that always rears its ugly head.
Yeah. Get back down.
So, by problematizing it in the case of Bhaktisiddhanta, are you accepting it in the case of, let's say, Vivekananda or Dayananda Saraswati, or does it problematize all of these characters? Do you think?
Yeah, so as in for the MST, is kind of I limited it to just one specific person, but for the default application, I've also kind of expanded it to include Vivekananda specifically in order to kind of, yeah, try and increase my workload, I guess, but also to try and to try and create it across like as wide as possible, to create as many understandings from within traditions to kind of to bolster the proposal, I guess.
Okay, I guess thanks so much for that.
No, thanks guys, it was good to feedback.